side is going to be perfect here, so it's a, an X rotation, and then we end up with this third blade, which is exactly like the first blade. And of course, at the end of the day, we're going to measure longitude. And it's useful to sketch out quickly the block picture. The reason I write it like this, you know, we've been writing in terms of matrices, but then this makes it really easy to ask what's happening on a block sphere. And so you could take our block sphere picture, and of course, since here we're just in SU2, the block sphere picture is going to be complete. And what does it say? It says, okay, we start off along the positive z direction. We have some rotation about the y-axis. And, you know, of course, we would like that for the interferometry application to be just 90 degrees. Okay? But, you know, it's going to be whatever it is. And then we'll get, so this is the first piece, this is a bit of a lot. And it'll get some rotation phi of z. And of course, that's under our control, right? This phase flap rotates anywhere we like. And so we can go anywhere in that plane, which again, ideally should be the xy plane. We end up somewhere. And then there's this pi rotation, 180-degree rotation about the x-axis. That's going to take us over here somewhere. And actually, if we're above the xy plane, it should take us below the xy plane, right? It's you know, we get perfection here just by renormalizing. We're above, we're below here. And then we get another rotation of theta by 100, by, we get another rotation on the block sphere of theta about y. So that's going to take us down somewhere close to the z-axis. Okay. Now, it's not going to get quite along the z-axis. So you can see, you know, where it gets to depends upon what this rotation is. But you can also see a sort of nice thing. And I want you to look at this yourself. Because this is perfect, right? This says, oh, we ended up somewhere in the northern hemisphere when we get this. This took us to the southern hemisphere, and then we continued. But in fact, this rotation, the fact that this is perfect, makes us less sensitive to the errors that we have here. Okay, so follow the block trajectory, or just look at the overall physics, you'll see that. Now, what happened here last class? Last class, we said, oh, there's a magnetic let me say one more thing. Remember that last class we talked about what would happen if we just had the only transmission or only reflection. And of course what we saw was that the path swap. That's exactly what we want to see, is that negative to the negative axis. And so, you know, if things work out here, we're measuring, we start with longitude, we get to negative two. Okay. Last class, we looked at what would happen if we had a magnetic interaction. So we put a magnetic field just under this tab. And of course, we said that there were two spin states. There are two spin states of the neutron. We allow the neutron to start in the fully mixed state in regards to spin. So the spin was equally likely to be up or down. There was no coherence. The initial state was either up or down. And so we could draw two paths here. And the only difference, right, but this piece is independent of spin. The only difference would be that we would have a separation here in the face. Okay, and often if you're looking at what happens with your dynamics, it's useful to map it onto the block sphere. And of course, anything that we've called incoherence is going to show up as a distribution of points on the surface of the block sphere. And what will show up as decoherence in our models will be a reduction of the block vector. We'll end up inside the block sphere. Yeah. Good. Now, I want to make it the next piece. And this came about, this is a set of experiments. As I told you, yeah.
I didn't quite follow why you would explain that. Wouldn't the very section be the error by rotation about
y-axis? Okay. Remember that here we would like this angle to be 90 degrees. Right? So we saw last time that if the angle wasn't 90 degrees, then we would reduce the contrast, right? And we looked at the model for that. And the model was that we would say that the dynamics of the system, the output, is going to be a probability that we have the correct piece. So U ideal of phi rho in U ideal of phi inverse. In ideal, for ideal, U ideal, right here. Theta is equal to pi over 2. Right? So that we create the full superposition that we want, the equal superposition over the pass, and we go through this. So that was that piece, but then we said, well, okay, there's the rest of the probability, and the rest of the probability has a term that looks like, now, don't hold me to that x, it might be y. Whatever it is in the notes is correct, but in fact, since we start off here with the fiducial state, it won't make any difference, but if you're going to write a model, you should get it right, but I'm not going to look it up for you. So it's either x or y, but it's just, well, good. By accident, I get it right. So here we have a model that says, yep, we get some piece right, and then we get this piece, which doesn't show any quantum behavior. It just says, hey, you had a neutron coming in on a path, and it came out on a path. And, you know, nothing interesting happened. Okay? And, okay, you can't make the neutron interferometer without these mirrors here. But if you look at the trajectory, the error associated with the first blade was that we didn't get to the x-axis. The error associated with the third blade would be that we didn't get quite to the z-axis, right? What we would like to think that we're doing, I draw it over here. What we'd like to think we're doing is this. We'd like to think that we get all the way to this axis. And then we spread the information out somewhere in the xy plane. And then I take that xy plane and I rotate it until it is perfectly in the zy plane. And then we make a measurement, projective measurement, along the z-axis. Yeah? That's the experiment. And of course, it shows you exactly that we don't have universal control because we get one plane. Yeah? Okay. But we don't get there, and those are the errors. Thanks. Okay, so other questions? No. As I was saying, the experiment I'm going to describe now and its analysis came out of our desire to build another neutron interferometer. We built a neutron interferometer. We spent a lot of time
And at the end of the day, it had what I consider to be lousy contrast, about 38% contrast. And what my colleague told me at the end was, oh, you're really lucky that that they usually don't work out that well. And my thought was that, hey, you let me spend a year and a half doing something that you thought had a 2% chance of success. It's not a very friendly thing to do. And I want to show you where those errors come from. And then we're going to tell you actually how to get rid of them, that we can use quantum information processing to avoid these errors, exactly because they're incoherent. Okay, so I'm going to change this model, and it helps to look at it on edge. So if I look at it this way, we've got our neutron beam coming in. Remember, the neutron beam is a thick beam. It's about 8 millimeters. And we're going to put a wedge of silica. And this wedge of silica, I'm going to put in only one of those paths. Okay. And so as I do that, I'm going to introduce a phase shift. And this blade looks, it has the same composition as the phase flag, except, of course, the phase will vary because it depends upon the length of the material. And the angle that we get out there is pi divided by 40 microns times the path length through that blade. And I'm going to put a prime here because, of course, it's the path length along that direction. It's not the path length this way. Yeah?
So what's the
phase flag on this wedge? So the phase flag is machined perfectly flat, so every element of the neutron beam sees exactly the same phase flag, whereas the wedge, the piece of the beam that comes in at the top sees one phase shift, and the piece of the beam that comes in at the bottom sees another phase shift. Yeah?
You're basically bringing the homogeneity along the z direction.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so here we're saying that, look, it depends upon the width of this, but the width of it depends exactly, as you said, along the z coordinate, right? So phi of z is equal to k, I think I called it q in my notes, let's be consistent, q times z, where q is the wave number of this. So q has units of 2 pi reciprocal length. Yeah? And so there's our Q, depending upon how we build this, right? We can choose that angle as we like. All right. Now, other than that, as you just said, it looks exactly like the phase flag. And so it's just going to be another Z rotation. But it's going to be a Z rotation where we have this distribution over Z. And of course, our incoming beam, we're saying that here we have a probability of Z that is equal to a constant for some range of Z. And is zero otherwise, right? There's some width where the beam is constant, and then there's some piece where it falls to zero. And so we can carry out the experiment just as it was before. Here, of course, what we would see, if we looked at this model, Well, it doesn't matter where the neutron beam is. It doesn't matter where the neutron is in a beam. The first blade is always going to do the same thing. We will get to dispersion of phases here. And then, of course, what will happen is the second, well, the mirror in the second third blade will act independently of where it is in the beam. So if I had gone back to the figure and left it up here that I had, we would have spread out over this XY plane in the dephasing. So that's easy. So the intensity in the O beam is equal to the probability in Z trace of the operator that we're looking at, which is 0, 0. If we're looking at the O beam, the output state, which depends upon Q and Z. We're going to integrate over Z, and this will be over some range, the same range I gave there. Now, this won't surprise you that this is going to end up looking like a sinc function, right, in this particular case, right, because we have a square beam. But let's go ahead and have a look at what this actually does look like. Good. Okay, so what I've plotted here is the O beam intensity versus the phase versus Q, right? I mean, Q is the pitch of this prism. And so Q equals zero, there's no prism. As we increase it, we increase the width of the base of the prism. And you can see, of course, exactly as you'd like, that when Q is equal to zero, we get the full contrast. As Q increases, we lose the contrast. And if we look at a element of this is actually the experimental data, it in fact does look like a sinc function in the O beam. And the one you want to look at is the taller one. Now, let's go over here. Let me go back. This isn't so the one I want to show you anyways. Let's go back to this picture. Here it says as we increase the wave number of the grating, if we increase the thickness of the prism, we lose contrast, but we lose contrast in a really nice way. That what happens is that we have the contrast that varies over the sample. The phase varies linearly over the sample. And so as I showed you before, quickly, we can put a position-sensitive detector there. So we'll have a detector that has boron 10, and then a CCD camera. And so we'll get out a picture of the beam instead of just using the helium-3 camera to integrate that. And when we do that, what do we see? So now instead of integrating over the beam for each position in Z, I'm going to get a separate measurement. And we saw that the phase of the neutron beam, right, the phase of the contrast depended upon location. And when we integrate it over it, it goes to zero because we're integrating a sinusoidal variation. Okay? But when I leave it alone, of course, then I see that phase grating. So here, as a function of Q, we see that we introduce a phase modulation over this grating. Yeah?
That's the height of the grating.
You're right, this is the Z direction. Yeah. And it's a little bit nicer just to see it in the real data. Right? So here, that doesn't show up very well. If you look at it in the notebooks, it looks a little bit clearer. But here you can see the periodicity of the grating. We've changed the Q vector as we move through here. It's a position-sensitive detector. You can also see, if you look at this individual counts, that you can see in this system that we can see individual neutron events. The reason we don't use a position-sensitive detector for most of what we do is a position-sensitive detector is abysmally, has low quantum efficiency. Because I need, in that first boron, I need two things. I need to stop a neutron, but it's going to create a photon. And the photon is going to move to the charge to the CCD camera. And if I make the boron thick, then that capture event can happen anywhere in that thickness. And as you transfer the light energy to the CCD, you blur the effect because there's a long length. So I want the boron to be thin. But if the boron's thin, then the capture efficiency is low. So we want high resolution, we lose sensitivity. Yeah?
How long does it take to get all this data?
It's for one of these, it takes about an hour.
You said 1 neutron per second?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we can go through and count the. But it's about an hour. Yes?
So, what's the difference? Which is shifted between the three graphs?
The prism. So the prism, we're making it fatter and fatter and fatter. And, you know, that doesn't seem like an easy thing to do with silica. You know, you have a prism, you say, okay, now I want it to be a little fatter. But if you have two prisms, this is Dimas. All the data I show you is taken by Dmitry Pushin. And if you look in the first notebook, you'll see his picture. If I have two prisms, that are exactly the same, and they're circular, and I rotate them relative to each other, then I can make them have effectively no, effectively they look flat in this case, and as I rotate them relative to each other, you get into a regime where it looks like that, and we get the nice fat prism. So by rotating these two, and of course, I should have drawn it this way. We put them back to back. But it doesn't matter. It's the same physics. So we rotate them, and we can get a continuous variation of the Q value. And that's what we do here.
So I have another question.
Yeah,
so in
please.
The above picture, why is your contrast fringes like?
That's a mistake of how it's plotted. So that's really, I should change that. Because effectively I have Z going this way, and we have, so this is increasing Z. I should change that. Now, if we put position-sensitive detectors in both beams, then of course what we see is the complement of the grating from one to the next. Yeah. So all of that works out perfectly fine. The No. I want to ask here. When we went to describe this data, we got a surprising complaint from the referees. Referees can amuse you. And they said, hey, this isn't really incoherence, even though we showed the bloody grating. They said, you've lost the information, you can't recover it. So I say, okay. What happens if I put a prism here, and then I put the same prism here? What happens to my contrast in that case? It's the same as it was without the prisms. So that by putting the two prisms there, we've created here, in this leg, we've said, oh yes, let's put an operator that is e to the I q z in this leg, and then I say, oh, up here I have an operator e to the I q z in that leg, and so together it just becomes a global phase, and of course the contrast isn't going to depend upon a global phase. So by varying these two q's independently, when they're both the same, our contrast returns, which is exactly like an echo experiment in other forms of spectroscopy. And I leave it to you for a homework problem to show, if I look at this from the side, here's my neutron interferometer from the side, and we have a prism. And if I have the other prism, which is exactly the same prism, but it's not lined up in the same plane. But of course, the beam is only goes where there's both prisms. It makes no difference, right? Explain to me sometime why it is that I don't care how these prisms are placed along the z-axis. As long as the beam overlaps it, it doesn't matter how those are placed. Yeah?
I'm not sure about the geometry of that.
So one prism is in each beam.
Right, but they're not at the same height.
That's right. Yeah. So if we look at the contrast, so I just set the Q in one path to 10. And then I vary the Q in the second path. And this is the phase, and that's the O beam intensity. And you see, of course, that as we replace the Q factor in the second path to what it was in the first, then we return and get our full contrast. All right, life is good. Now then, I want to take this and extend it to what the real problem is in neutron interferometry. The problem in neutron interferometry, of course, isn't that we accidentally put a prism in our system. The problem in the neutron interferometry is that there's noise on the blades. So for as hard as we work to make these blades perfectly flat, it's very difficult to avoid imperfections in the blades. And we need to avoid imperfections at the length scale of microns. And you can see that you can't machine this surface perfectly flat. We can cut it, but this is a long distance. And it's inside a delicate crystal. So normally when we polish something, we take something flat and we polish it from one side. But we can't do that with this. So let's see how this works. Don't need that. So now what happens is you have small imperfections on your blades. So pretend those are all small. And we're going to treat those imperfections solely as a variation in the face. Okay? Because 40 microns doesn't change the Bragg condition, doesn't change the transmission reflection probabilities we're talking about. But it absolutely does change the phase, right? That's why we do interferometry, because we're bloody sensitive to the phase. Okay? And now we have to ask, well, how do we want to model this? In some ways, it's easy to model. You say, oh, I'm going to put a random phase noise here. And we know what the phase noise looks like. It looks like a Z rotation. Okay? So we say, oh, yes, I'm going to put a Z rotation in here. And I'll choose some model for the distribution of phases. And if we think it's random, then a Gaussian model sounds like a good model to choose. And we could choose the width and the amplitude, and life was good. But before we do that, right now, we've described this in terms, I've drawn it in terms of six random noises. And I want to reduce that. I don't want six random noises. So does anyone see offhand how we can reduce this?
Can you join like these parts and these parts?
Absolutely. You're saying, look, I know that at this place and at this place, there's no phase information that's going to change. The state coming in is along the z-axis, and the measurement we make out here, doesn't matter where the state is pointed, but the measurement we make, our observables, are along the z-axis. So right away we can say, those things don't matter. And so now we get down to four noise sources. Get rid of a few more. So we can take two things. One, I can say, let me take this and this one and just put them together. Because I know that the only thing that happens here is this Z rotation. And these are Z rotations. So if I have three Z rotations in a row, well, they just add. So I'm going to add those two, and I'm going to add those two. And then we say, look, I have this perfect pulse there, which is going to just take a Z operator to a negative Z operator. But the noise is random. Yeah? So I can add it again. So now then, all I need to do is to have, in fact, one noise source, which corresponds to the sum of all of the errors in those blades. Now, as we sum these up, we need to remember that we're summing up random processes, right? But okay, I'm not going to go through that. But you know that if we take a sum of four Gaussian processes, we're going to get out the Gaussian process. And that piece is enough for now. So I have one random noise. And what we're going to do is to say that if I look at the probability of getting out some phase, that probability is going to be Gaussian. It's going to be normalized to 1, right? Because as you have to get out the phase for every neutron that goes through, so it's going to be appropriately normalized. And it's going to be centered at 0. So why do I center it at 0? I center it at 0 because I still have this phase flag here. So if this was shifted over by some amount, well, whatever amount that was shifted over by, I'm going to put it into the phase flag anyways, because I've never had I've never found the zero phase point of that phase flag, right? All we're using the phase flag for is to introduce a difference in phase. We're not trying to find the point where the phase is zero. So I don't know how much of the phase comes from this, or how much of the phase comes from this, or how much of the phase comes from the noise. So we just say, okay, all the noise, we're going to make it stationary. We'll distribute it about zero. And any contribution that is uniformly away from zero, we'll just assign it arbitrarily to the phase flag. Okay, so now then we have this nice picture, and it's just a probability, and we know that it's going to look like e to the minus, let's call it delta phi squared over 2 sigma squared, 1 over the square root of 2 pi sigma, unless I've made some mistake. But that seems pretty good. Yeah, everything's good. Okay, and of course, the only parameter we have here is sigma, which is the width of this distribution. Right. Good. So we've got this piece where this is the probability as a function of delta phi. So we can put that in there, we can integrate the whole process and have a look at what the overall model is. So we do that. Okay, so we define a Gaussian distribution. It's no surprise to any of you what a Gaussian looks like. We calculate, and of course the nice thing about a Gaussian is you can integrate it explicitly, so we can get an analytic result for the intensities in terms of error functions and then we can look at what happens to the O-beam intensity as we vary the width of that Gaussian distribution. Okay, and what we see, of course, is that as we increase the width of that distribution, the O-beam intensity goes to having no contrast, and simply half of the neutrons leave through the O-beam. Right? And exactly the same thing better happen for the H-beam intensity. Again, we see that as we increase the width of that distribution, we lose contrast, and we obtain a result which was half the neutrons being there. Okay. So now that we have a model for what happens in the case that we have Gaussian noise. We have this dephasing model, right? And so we can talk about how that introduces a model over here. So we take our physics model, and you're going to have to let me now redefine the probability. So initially, in the model of the neutron interferometer, we said, oh, there's a probability that it works, and there's a probability due to the transmission coefficient, right, that we get the wrong thing, and the wrong thing is boring. Yeah? I'm going to remove these probabilities, because now I'm saying that we have a probability that the transmission reflection coefficient are not equal. So T is not equal to R. That's the probability. We get this thing, right? And now that we have a probability of Gaussian noise, Gaussian phase noise, right? And we know that what's happening with the Gaussian phase noise is that at the phase flag, we're introducing a random phase, right? So we're dephasing the system at that point. And you looked at yesterday, what the Krauss operators for dephasing operation were, right? So the Krauss operators for dephasing look like this. So now then we can say that we have a probability which is the sum over k prime I write it as k prime, not k, because of course I need to include the rest of the interferometer in here, right? So we'll need to write that out. We'll say that, hey, this piece only shows up in the dephasing piece of the interferometer. Okay, so, well, that's easy enough. What happened? We said that we had the blade, but remember that this blade is perfect here, because the imperfections of the blade, they showed up here. All right, this blade is perfect. Then we had the phase flag of phi. Then we have the Krauss picture, k sub I, over here. And then we have the mirror. Then we have the blade again. Okay? And so this piece becomes k sub I. Prime.
So now we have a complete model for this. You can go through. And of course, the probabilities over the whole thing better add up.
I think it might fill up.
Sorry.
So, the probabilities should still add up. Like so. And now we have our complete model. If it's a complete model, it would be very nice if it actually corresponded to the data we have. So let's look. So now what I've done is I repeat the calculation in the notebook to add in the loss of transmission, to look at the transmission reflection coefficient. And I look at the phase noise. We put them both together. So I need two parameters. I need one parameter which says that the R, in this case, is the width of the Gaussian. okay? And T is the transmission reflection coefficient. So if I take R to zero, as I vary the transmission reflection coefficient, we see that we get our contrast, and it looks like we're only varying it from zero to pi here. Zero to pi over two, sorry. Yeah? And we know what the real data look like. Let me reduce the size of this so that we can see it together. Come on, reduce the size. That isn't so nice. Okay, yeah, there we go. All right, so still not quite perfect, but it'll do. Here's the real data. The real data, of course, doesn't quite go down to zero, and of course it doesn't go anywhere near, the O-beam doesn't go anywhere near one, right? Remember that the O-beam grows from zero, the H-beam grows from the full intensity, or is reduced from the full intensity. So we can go back to our model and know that we need to have some noise, but we should have much more transmission reflection coefficient, and see if we can get this about right. So anyways, something like that. We can find parameters within our model where the data in the simulated results at least look like they correspond. Right? So we, you know, here we can say yes, things are consistent with our picture. Yeah? So now we have a model which we can at least believe that it captures the essential physics. And I'll tell you that every experiment we do, this model has been sufficient to capture the physics of this. So now then, I want to look at two more things, and I'm going to let you guys do this yourselves. The first is to look explicitly at, oh yeah.
What did it say, like the K prime in the definition that it's you play and then you
mirror?
You mirror.
Right? And then these dephasing coefficients, these dephasing operators, and then the phase, and then the initial blade.
Okay.
Right? So, you know, picture this as half of the dynamics, or I shouldn't say it that way. Don't need this. Perfect. So this is k sub I of sigma, which I just erased. The mirror, the blade, the let me put it as a small p for now. All right, so that shows the full dynamics of this system. And the only thing I haven't done for you is to relate P as a function of sigma, so width of that probability event. And the so, 1 over sigma squared.
So let me. Part of the dynamics that we get because of the imperfections in the blades.
That's right. This is the part that tells us because the blades have roughness that's leading to random phase shifts, this is the piece that we get out of that. Right? And, you know, notice it's a little bit different than this particular model. This particular model says, hey, I just have a piece that has no coherence. Right? Here, this actually does have coherence. Right? For every neutron, if I could imagine doing that, there's a particular phase. And if we could imagine having a really, really tiny neutron detector that we could scan over the blade, then for every location, we should see a phase. That's correct. But since we don't have that, then we have to sum over these and we lose the contrast. Just like when we had that grating due to the wedge, that as we moved down the beam, we saw a different phase. It's exactly the same physics, except here the phase is random with location, whereas in the wedge, of course, it has a simple relationship. But here, there is an underlying phase still for every location. And that's a piece that we're using right now. I don't have time to tell it to you today, but I'll tell it to you before the class is out. This phase was never lost until we made a measurement. So we have another degree of freedom. We have the neutron spin. And so I can use the neutron spin to create a correlated state between the spin degrees of freedom in these phases. And then I can recover contrast in this system by how I treat the spin. So we can make a neutron interferometer that would lose contrast because of these random phases, and we can bring the contrast back by using the spin degree of freedom as a measurement to recognize what the phase is. And it's a nice description of using ideas that Daniel talked to you about in quantum error correction applied to physical systems. We can use those the error correcting codes not only to try to make quantum computers, but actually to improve measurements. Okay? So, here's your complete model. There's nothing missing. As you're talking about it, one of the interesting points to ask is, why don't you have to worry about the case where there's both errors? Notice what I did here. I said, oh, well, here's a system that's perfect. Here's a system where the transmission and reflection coefficients have an error. Here's a system where there's a phase error. I never calculated for you what happens when the transmission reflection coefficients have an error and there's a phase error. And physics says we don't have to. So think about why that is the case, that I don't need to include effectively a cross term between those two. And it's not because these probabilities are small. It's because of the physics. Yeah.
So we actually add these things, right?
Yeah.
The data.
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. And at this point, you have the model for everything you could do. Well, tomorrow what I'll do is I'll take the same piece and we'll look at it in terms of a wave model of quantum mechanics. So I don't want to say you have everything that a complete piece of the physics for SU2 for the neutron interferometer. You have everything that's treating the neutron as a particle, okay? And you can think about any of the demonstrations of quantum mechanics that one could do with a particle interferometer and ask, with this real model of what you're going to see, what you can honestly show, and what we've learned as a community from 40 years of neutron interferometry work. I don't know if you guys read Tony Leggett's books. Tony, of course, is a leading figure in the continuing development of quantum mechanics, and a member of IQC and the Perimeter Institute, and mainly at the University of Illinois at Urbana. And he writes beautifully. So you get a chance to read his books, and you always have them. I'm sure they're in the library over there. Read his books, and he uses neutron interferometry as an example of physics. If you look at quantum mechanics, if you look at, remind me of the physicist or the quantum text from Simon Fraser. Ballantine, thank you. If you look at Ballantine's book, which is really a nice book to read, or if you look at Asher Perez's book, they use neutron interferometry as an test case for demonstrating elements of quantum mechanics. So go back and think about what they're telling you, and think about it in terms now of a full description of the physics. And let's ask ourselves what we can learn from this and what we can't learn from it. And tomorrow what we'll do is we'll look at the last piece of single particle physics, which is to say that we can treat a particle as a wave. And can we use a neutron interferometer, which sounds like a really particle-centric device, to demonstrate the wave properties of quantum mechanics? Of course we can. Yeah?
But aren't we doing that by doing the interference experiment?
In a different way. So I agree with you that you would say anytime you have a wave function, then there's elements of wave mechanics, and of course, you know, Schrodinger is as valid here as anywhere else. It's a little bit different when you're thinking about having a wave packet.
Oh, I see, wave packet. Yeah.
So that's the element we'll look at. Okay. Thank you.
David, about the other building.